Welcome to this Good Lit podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California. The Good Lit series brings literary and culinary luminaries to the podium. I'm Gina Baleria, Director of Literary Events at the club. To learn more about our programs or become a member, go to commonwealthclub.org. To take part in a discussion about what you hear, blog at commonwealthlit.blogspot.com.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Barbara Otto, a former Group Executive Vice President of Bank of America and a member of the Board of Governors of the club. Thank you. You'll find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is part of the Food Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guests, authors Amanda Hesser and Dorothy Allison, editor and contributor, respectively, of the new book, Eat, Memory, Great Writers at the Table. The book's 26 food-inspired recollections from some of America's leading writers were collected from Ms. Hesser's New York Times Magazine column called Eat, Memory. The book includes many recipes that inspired these highly personal memories. Amanda Hesser, food writer, editor, and author, is a food columnist at the New York Times Magazine, where her column, Recipe Redux, appears monthly. She was hired by the Times in 1997 and has been a food reporter for the Dining In, Dining Out section, the food editor of the Sunday Magazine, and the editor of the quarterly, Tea Living. Amanda has published two books, The Cook and the Gardener, and Cooking for Mr. Latte, A Food Lover's Courtship, both of which won the International Association of Culinary Professionals Literary Food Writing Award. Her next book, a collection of New York Times noteworthy recipes from 1853 until today, will be published next year. Dorothy Allison is the author of the prize-winning novels Bastard Out of Carolina, one of the five finalists for the 1992 National Book Award, and Cave Dweller, a New York Times bestseller, as well as the books Two or Three Things I Know for Sure, Trash, Skin, and the book of poetry, The Women Who Hate Me. Ms. Allison was Emory University Center for Humanistic Inquiry's Distinguished Visiting Professor this year and will be McGee Professor and Writer-in-Residence at Davidson College in North Carolina. She is currently working on her third novel, She Who. I'm pleased to report that although born in South Carolina, Miss Allison describes herself as a happily born-again Californian. Yes. So please join me in welcoming Amanda Hesser and Dorothy Allison.
Thank you.
In preparation for today's meeting, I actually Googled food and memories in the generic sense. And if you could believe it, over 32 million searches were found.
Oh, yes.
I did not read each and every one. but obviously, the book does strike quite a chord. And I was wondering if you would like to comment as to why you think food is such an evocative experience for people. So, Amanda, would you like to start?
Sure. Well, I think that, the thing about food is that it's not about the food itself always, the memory. I think food, because it's engages all of your senses, it ends up being this kind of powerful way of earmarking, important moments in your life.
Great.
It's one of the things you learn as a writer is to go down that list of all of the senses. Mm-hmm. And food, well, if you approach it with the right understanding, food evokes all of the senses, taste, touch, smell, especially smell. but because it hits all of those touch points, it stays with you. And the food you learn to love when you're young, when you're acquiring memories, all those associations become so complicated and so set. I can close my eyes and remember each of my aunts by their favorite meals they cooked. And occasionally, tobacco.
We won't talk about that.
Well, we could, but it does get in the way of appreciating your food.
As I mentioned, there are 26 different short stories that comprise this collection, some with recipes, and they were all gleaned from columns, Amanda, that you had approached authors, writers, poets, so forth. What was the winnowing process like? How did you decide, yes, this one will make the collection, this one, although wonderful, somehow won't, without naming names, so I don't want to get you in trouble, but how did that process?
Well, it was a difficult process. I mean, just it was mostly, you know, that I wanted it to be this kind of like, you know, tightly knit collection, and a lot of the, you know, and the really, you know, the stories that I really enjoyed most or got a lot of feedback on, you know, I heard, you know, people talking about, and I think that, you know, the different stories kind of naturally fell into groupings, which are now the way the book is divided into a group called Discoveries, a group called Illusions, a group called Struggles, and you know, so it was also a way of you know, selecting ones that would sort of you know, kind of felt like they would go together and sort of work together as a book, rather than just sort of throwing them all in there just because they ran.
Great. Were there, as you've been collecting these stories for your column, were there any you just flat out rejected? I know you had one rule, no sentimentality with submissions for the column. Were there any that, you know, you just read and said, well, absolutely not, this couldn't be published, again, without naming names? Or,
No. I mean, the whole, I mean, the genesis of the column was that, you know, I felt that there were two things. One was that, you know, because I write about food, people are often talking to me about food and often telling me, you know, some story from their life that, you know, involved food. So, you know, it occurred to me that, well, everyone has a good food story. You know, not everyone is a writer, and wouldn't it be interesting to have, you know, writers who we know and love, like Dorothy, you know, tell a story about an important moment in their lives that involved food, and so that's sort of how the column came about. And then, you know, on top of that, I just felt like while everyone has those stories where there's a food that they feel kind of sentimental about, there's not necessarily an engaging story that goes along with that food, and no one really wants to read about that.
Actually, you provided the perfect segue. Darth, I was wondering if you would like to read your contribution.
Why, I have a copy of a book. Yes. It's wonderful. This is... When this was published, it was astonishing to me how many people called and wrote me about it, not only about their recipes, but about the whole concept of gravy. I know about that. The story's called Crossing to Safety. Gravy is the simplest, tastiest, most memory-laden dish I know. A little flour, salt, pepper, crispy bits of whatever meat anchored the meal, a couple of cups of water or milk, and slow stirring to break up lumps. That's it. It smells of home. The door locked against the night, and a stillness made safe by the sound of a spoon going around in a pan. It is anticipation. The last thing prepared before the meal comes to the table, the bowl in Mama's hand closing the day out peacefully, no matter what came before. My mother's gravy was a savory country gravy, heavy on the black pepper. Best of all was steak, cube steak gravy. People call it country fried steak, but Mama always called it cube steak. And she began with odd indented slabs of very cheap meat carried home from the diner where she was on her feet all day. My sisters and I would pound the steak while she rested. That little round mouth of the Coke bottle thudded into the meat over and over until each piece was not only dimpled but flattened out again half as wide as it had been. By the time Mama stopped us, the steaks would be tenderized almost to pieces. Then she would shoo us out of the way, make up the biscuits, sift some of the flour onto a plate. Dredged in flour, the steaks went into a hot cast-iron skillet with a good covering of bacon fat. So long as we set the table and were useful, we were allowed to watch Mama cook those steaks and then set them aside on a brown paper bag. Then she took the plate of leftover flour, sprinkled it in the pan, and stirred it, stirred it as it browned, and the pan filled up with little brown flour pebbles and charred bits of meat. A lot of water, a little milk, made steam rise up in a sweet cloud. Mama worked the gravy with a fork until all was smooth and silky. She might pour the gravy over the steaks, or she might serve it in a bowl, but it was not until I was grown that I understood gravy poured over the meat before it came to the table meant there was not much meat. In one tract house or another, first in South Carolina and then Florida when I was a teenager, my mother made magic with cheap meat, flour, and determination, hiding from us how desperate things might be. She did such a good job of it, we came to believe cube steak a luxury better than the rare T-bones our uncles might bring around as a surprise. My son, Wolf, was born when I was past 40 and the author of a best-selling novel. That means he has grown up a middle-class child, one who sometimes asks me for stories of my childhood, but who knows nothing of what it means to grow up poor and afraid. I have worked to make sure of that. His favorite foods, dishes I never even knew existed until I was a voting adult, spinach souffle, steamed mussels, sautéed Brussels sprouts. The child has almost never eaten an egg yolk, and he never took an interest in gravy, not even on Thanksgiving turkey. "No, thank you, Mama," he would say politely. My feelings were hurt. How could my child not like my gravy? Maybe it was the giblets I chopped and added. So next time, I made a smooth, pristine gravy, no bits of anything. Wolf would not touch it. This time I sighed. I had to face the truth. My gravy was nowhere near as good as my mother's had been. And my son was not me. He had never gone to bed hungry. He had no idea how important a locked door might be. And I could not be unhappy about that. But then there was the duck. It was 3 years ago. I wanted to do something special for the holidays to celebrate our Aunt Mary moving up from Arizona. At the grocery, there was a big sale sign. Ducks and geese on major discount. A duck, a goose, a British Christmas dinner. I had read those novels. I had a brand new roasting pan. So just because I could, I bought one of each. The goose for Christmas, the duck for New Year's. Christmas was wonderful, but the goose was not a success. It came out pretty, but dry. I stripped the leftovers for the dogs and worried. What was I going to do with a duck? I thought about giving up and getting a ham, but my pride got in the way. I could cook. I was my mother's daughter. It was clear to me that what was going to be necessary was a gravy, a great gravy. I read up on ducks. I followed directions. I hung the bird over the sink in the warm kitchen and watched the fat drip off. After a while, it looked greasy but lean. Then I shooed everyone out of my kitchen and went back to basics. There might not be any bacon fat in the fridge, but there was bacon. I wrapped that duck in bacon. Then I threw an obscuring layer of aluminum foil over the top and put it in the roasting pan. Anything made with bacon will be fine. You could smell it in the steam coming out the top of the oven, but maybe I was the only one who noticed. It was New Year's. There was family, friends, lots of dishes. There were greens, black-eyed peas, and sweet potatoes with marshmallows. There were pies and loud music, lots of things to distract everyone from the oven. And when the duck was done, I set it on a platter, disappeared the bacon slices, poured off the grease, and took a spoon after the blackened bits in the bottom of the pan. Maybe the duck would be as dry as that goose had been, but the bits in the bottom of the pan, they were great crackling. I scraped and dredged and turned on the heat, sprinkled flour, pepper across the oily surface. It cooked into familiar brown pebbles. I squeezed a bite between my fingers and tasted that salty brown flavor, rich. A cup of skim milk brought up steam. I stirred. Another cup went after the first, then a cup of water. I used a fork to squash the lumps and kept stirring steadily. Every now and then, I would taste the gravy and then go searching in my cupboard. Yeah, more black pepper. A little bit of K. Paul's Louisiana kitchen sauce. And at the last minute, I reached over and spooned in the creamy liquid off the black-eyed peas. It made me laugh, but that gravy smelled wonderful. Soon, there were offers to help carry in the dishes. My son was standing by the stove. He was staring at the gravy I was still stirring. And then he leaned forward. And I just looked at him. Big green eyes, wide and hungry. I used a wooden spoon, blew on it to cool it, and then let him taste my gravy. "Oh, that's wonderful," he said. And then everyone was quick to the table. The duck was perfect. I felt as if I had passed some ancient rite, earned some essential vindication, and there was no gravy left when the meal was done. Every now and then, I make duck again, but more often I do what I know. I roast a chicken, I pan fry a steak, I make pan gravy. Sometimes my boy comes to watch, and I watch him. He's getting so tall, now 4 inches taller than I am, and growing faster all the time. The world looms ever larger and more uncertain, but I try not to worry. I try to make him feel he is home and safe, and will always be so, no matter what comes to the door.
I think we'll all be making a beeline to a restaurant and call it quits here.
It's San Francisco, there's lots.
Amanda, a question for you. You have a degree in economics and finance, and yet right after graduation you went off to Europe, went through cooking school, studied at Le Varenne, worked in restaurants and bakeries, and then began to write a column for newspapers and magazines about food. What was the impetus for that? And if you could talk a little bit about the experience, and were there any problems given your gender, nationality, and language issues?
You mean in Europe? Going
yes,
to Europe?
Yes.
You want me to say sort of why I went into food from finance?
Yes.
Well, that perhaps was a mistake. I mean, in terms of stability and et cetera. But, I was like a typical college student. I sort of decided based on really no information that I would study this, and then quickly became bored and felt disoriented and started kind of searching around. But that's sort of the wonderful thing about college is you have an opportunity to kind of, explore whatever you feel like. And so I was in Boston or outside of Boston, and I decided to get a job at a restaurant and a bakery. And, soon I was kind of on my way into this this sort of food adventure. And, my mother, I left for Europe to study cooking there, and a period that my mother, described as when people asked what I was doing, she said, "Oh, well, Amanda's finding herself," which was true. And, it just took me a while, and I wasn't really sure what I was going to end up doing, but ended up becoming a writer, sort of.
Did you find it difficult as an American woman?
Oh, as an American woman. All right. Sorry, the second part of your question. Actually, I didn't. And in fact, I feel like I benefited from sexism, seems like a strange thing to say, but when I would go to work in restaurants, the male apprentices would be placed in these horrible lodgings, places that you would never want to sleep. And for some reason, they were sort of, shocked and not really sure what to do with a woman. And so I was often put up, in a room in someone's home and, had an actual bathroom that you would want to step inside.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Anyway, as surrounded as we are by wonderful writers, there are a number of related questions from the audience with respect to literature and food. And the questions are, what literary meal do you remember most? Is there a passage from a novel or a food essay that you consider a model? And then in a related vein, with writers whom you know who have read, have you noticed any connection between literary style and preferences in food? So,
life is a pop quiz.
I was going to say, you want to take that one?
It's odd. I know there are lots and lots of wonderful meals, but I remember reading, what is it, The World According to Garp, and he cooks peppers, and he puts the pepper over a flame takes it off and then peels it. And I never knew about that. And I tried it, and it worked. It was like this huge revelation. I had always known that you could find the truth in fiction, but I didn't know that you could find how to peel peppers.
There you go.
Yeah.
Amanda? I'm drawing a blank. Okay. I don't know if I can answer that one.
Well, sorry. I'll make it easier then.
Okay.
There is a lovely story among many in the book, and there is made reference to eating scenes in movies, and quote Tampopo and Babette's Feast. And I was curious as to any favorites either one of you may have from a movie scene where, you know, food is center stage or a protagonist.
You go first.
No, you go first.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I didn't prepare for.
What is it? Isn't Kim Basinger and those strawberries in front of the refrigerator? Do you remember that?
Oh.
So, I can't remember.
Oh, I've got one. Good. Cool Hand Luke.
Oh, with the eggs.
With the eggs, which is just kind of horrifying. I don't know if any of you have seen it, but he eats 50 eggs or something, which apparently he actually did.
You can tell.
You know, yeah, you can tell because it seems so real. He seems
sort of goes a green.
All the sort of emotion on his face, and it's really kind of disgusting but fascinating.
Put you off eggs.
That'll do it. but actually, that sort of leads to the previous question about how, like, a relationship between, you know, you were saying about the way a writer eats and then his or her prose.
Yes.
Well, it is kind of interesting because, you know, I asked Tom Perrotta, the author of Little Children and The Abstinence Teacher and other novels, to write a piece. And he's actually quite food phobic. And he in fact, won't eat eggplant because it has the word egg in it, which he says in his piece. And he writes about this and how it has sort of gotten him into trouble. But and in fact, he told me that after the piece ran, that he said it was like this huge relief because so many people wrote him, and he said that like for once, or you know, for the first time in his life, he doesn't have to be afraid to be invited over for dinner because now everybody knows it's all out in the open that he's like such. So he won't eat tomatoes. I mean, he has a very sort of long list of things that he won't eat. But but in fact, food does show up in his novels, and he said that one problem he's had is because a number of his novels have been turned into movies is that directors are always complaining that everyone's always around the table and they have to get them up from the table. So, he's someone you wouldn't expect to, isn't actually a big epicure.
Yes, it was a very funny story. One thing I did not mention that you have, I guess, a chapter devoted to you in a recently published book, Julie and Julia. Uh-huh. And it's about a young woman, I guess, who was unhappy in life and decides to each evening cook a recipe from Julia Child's The Art of French Cooking. And I guess got to be very popular through the blogosphere. And I guess a movie will be made. And I know you've met Julia Child, and mm-hmm. I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about that, and if I could also ask you to read the story in the book about Julia's near failure in trying to pass a cooking exam in Paris.
Oh, okay. You want me to just go ahead and read right now?
Sure.
Fantastic.
That'd be great.
It's called The Sauce and the Fury. And this is an excerpt from a book that Julia did with her nephew, I believe, Alex Prudhomme, and it was called My Life in Paris, and is about the years that she went to that she lived in Paris with her husband Paul Child. Julia Child became so famous, but many people don't realize that she never even learned to cook until she was nearly 40, or perhaps into her 40s, and so. She moved to Paris with Paul, and she decided, because he was working a lot, that she would go to cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu. By late 1950, I felt ready to take my final examination and earn my diploma from the Cordon Bleu in Paris. But when I asked Madame Brossard, the school's director, to schedule the test, politely at first, then with an increasing insistence, my requests were met with stony silence. The truth is that Madame Brossard and I got on each other's nerves. She seemed to think that awarding a student a diploma was like inducting them into some kind of secret society. As a result, the school's hallways were filled with an air of petty jealousy and distrust. From my perspective, Madame Brossard lacked professional experience, was a terrible administrator, and tangled herself up in picayune details and politics. Because of its exalted reputation, the Cordon Bleu's pupils came from all over the globe. But the lack of a qualified and competent head was hurting the school and could damage the reputation of French cooking, or even France herself, in the eyes of the world. I was sure that the little question of money had something to do with Madame Brossard's evasiveness. I had taken the professional course in the basement rather than the regular and more expensive course upstairs, which she had recommended. I never ate at the school, and she didn't make as much money out of me as she would have liked. It seemed to me that the school's director should have paid less attention to centimes and more attention to her students, who, after all, were, or could be, her best publicity. After waiting and waiting for my exam to be scheduled, I sent Madame Brossard a stern letter in March 1951, noting that all my American friends, and even the U.S. ambassador himself, knew I had been slaving away at the Cordon Bleu morning, noon, and night. I insisted that I take the exam before I left on a long-planned trip to the United States in April. If there was not enough space at the school, I added, then I would be happy to take the exam in my own well-appointed kitchen. More time passed, and still no response. I was good and fed up and finally spoke to Chef Bunyard, my professor, about the matter. He agreed to make inquiries on my behalf. Lo and behold, Madame Brossard suddenly scheduled my exam for the first week in April. Ha! I continued to hone my technique, memorize proportions, and prepare myself in every way I could think of. On the big day, I arrived at the school, and they handed me a little typewritten card that said, "Write out the ingredients for the following dishes to serve three people. Oeuf mollet, côtelettes de veau en surprise, crème renversée au caramel." I stared at the card in disbelief. Did I remember what an oeuf mollet was? No. How could I miss that? I later discovered that it was eggs that had been coddled and then peeled. How about veau en surprise? No. A sautéed veal chop with duxelles or hashed mushrooms on either side, overlaid with ham slices and all wrapped up in a paper bag, the surprise, that is then browned in the oven. Did I remember the exact proportions for caramel custard? No. Zut alors, and flute. I was stuck and had no choice but to make everything up. I knew I would fail the practical exam of the part of the exam. As for the written exam, I was asked how to make fond brun, how to cook green vegetables, and how to make sauce bernaise. I answered them fully and correctly, but that didn't take away the sting. I was furious at myself. There was no excuse for not remembering what a mole was, especially the details of a caramel custard. I could never have guessed at the veau en surprise, though, as the paper wrapping was just a lot of tomfoolery, the kind of gimmicky dish a little newlywed would serve up for her first dinner party to Epaté, the boss's wife. Caught up in my own romanticism, I had focused on learning far more challenging fare, filet de sole, poulard toulousain, sauce vénitienne. Whoa! There were no questions. I'm answering the other part of your question, which is that I obviously struggled with languages.
We won't know the
difference.
This
is so embarrassing. There were no questions about complicated dishes or sauces, no discussion about which techniques and methods I'd use. Instead, they wanted me to memorize basic recipes from the little taken from the little Cordon Bleu booklet, a publication written for beginner cooks that I had hardly bothered to take a look at. This exam was far too simple for someone who had devoted 6 months of hard work to cooking school, not to mention countless hours of her own time in the markets and behind the stove. My disgruntlement was supreme, my amour propre enraged, my bile overboiling. Worst of all, it was my own fault. I despaired that the school would ever deign to grant me a certificate. Me, who could pluck, flame, empty, and cut up a whole chicken in 12 minutes flat. Me, who could stuff a sole with the forcemeat of weak fish and serve it with a sauce au vin blanc, such as Madame Brossard could never hope to taste the perfection of. Me, the supreme mistress of mayonnaise, hollandaise, cassoulet, choucroute, flanquette de veau, pomme de terre, soufflé. Oh, sorry. Soufflé Grand Marnier, fond d'artichaut, onion glacé, mousse de faisan en gelée, galantines, terrines, pâtés. Me, alas. Later that afternoon, I slipped down to the Cordon Bleu's basement kitchen myself. I opened the school's booklet, found the recipes from the examination, oeuf mollé with sauce bernaise, côtelettes de veau en surprise, and crème renversée au caramel, and whipped them all up in a cold, clean fury. Then I ate them.
Thank you. Actually, for those of you who would like to duplicate the dishes and score an A in the exam, the recipes for those are in the book, and they go on forever. changing tone for just a minute, with the relentless globalization we're all witnessing now and the supersized me fast food world, what kind of food memories are we going to have, you know, for the next generation?
Oh, but when we cook for families, we always cook from family memory. I make my mother's dishes. So my son, I'm sure when he has children, he will make grits with shrimp. He will make the memory dishes that I've taught him. And I'm astonished. Julia Child, me, the queen of mayonnaise? No. I am the queen of mayonnaise. My son will make egg salad with lots of mayonnaise.
Great.
I think that, you know, there's nothing wrong with good memories with foods that aren't necessarily homemade, you know. I think there's something to be loved in junk food, you know.
I won't repeat that. But I will.
I'm in San Francisco, yes. So it's dangerous to say these things.
Yes, absolutely. And I'd just like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're talking tonight with authors Amanda Hesser and Dorothy Allison about the new book, Eat Memory. You mentioned Wolf in your story.
Yeah.
Are you teaching him to cook? That's
no,
one of the audience.
He's taking a cooking class in high school.
Huh.
Yes, he's a sophomore, and they're teaching him to cook. So far, it seems to always involve eggs, which is good. I always have eggs and mayonnaise.
With your new book, Amanda, did the availability of ingredients steer you as to which recipes from the 19th century or early 20th century got included or not?
A little bit. Like, I haven't... I'm sure I can find it, but I haven't made any of the terrapin recipes. Terrapin's turtle, and that was very popular. And actually, it was kind of like a luxury thing. You would go to Delmonico's to have terrapin. I know. and
cute little turtles.
Yes, lots of turtles. And there was, and also tripe was pretty popular, which we've talked about. And I haven't made any of the tripe dishes. But actually, there are a lot of the thing you don't see very much of is chicken. You know, there are very few chicken recipes. But then there are some very strange things in the New York Times archives. Like, there is actually a recipe for roasted cat, which is very odd. And I don't know, it's hard to tell in the archives because the way they presented the recipes, whether that was kind of done ironically or if it was just like, here's food for, it's, you know, the title's written in French, is, you know, and so it's unclear of whether they were kind of like, look at this, you know, foreign dish.
Tongue-in-cheek, as it were.
Yeah, I don't know. There's also roast stuffed lion's heart, in case you go on a safari, I suppose.
Well, I think there goes dinner appetite. Now, here's a fascinating question from the audience, and a question for both of you. Cooking well or writing well, which is harder, which requires more talent? Now, there's a loaded question.
We're going to have to get into a wrestling match at some point. In my family, one of the things that we're very clear on is that I go through seasons. And when I'm in writing season, we're mostly eating rice. And I cook very little. When I'm in cooking season, I'm not writing much. They've been eating well the last month. So, do you find that when you're really working and really writing and your mind is engaged? I can't, except for chopping vegetables.
Yeah,
I can chop vegetables when I'm writing.
Yeah.
We have a lot of vegetable soup.
Yeah, I tend to sort of cook more simply then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And, of course, writers win. Because, well, but think about it. You eat a great meal, and then it's gone. if you read a great story, the story stays and you can pick it up. And this is my bias. You have an answer?
Well, that's an interesting thing, because it's the whole sort of strange thing about like restaurant reviewing. Yeah. You know, if you know, like art critics, you know, they're reviewing the same thing that everyone is going to go and see. But you know, with a restaurant review, it's ephemeral. You know, everyone's experience is unique.
But don't they argue with you about when you review and they call you up and say, "But I loved the tomato soup. You're wrong."
Oh well, yes, there's. I mean, yeah. There's a fair amount of that.
I get a few people who argue with me about short stories, but not with the passion people argue about food.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially here.
Well, it's California. Yeah. We have the greatest produce in the world.
Which then segues into the next question. Both of you travel widely and are on the East Coast as well as the West Coast. How do you compare the, if you will, the food experience back east in the East Coast, particularly New York City, and here in the land of foodies in San Francisco? Any glaring differences that really stand out to either one of you?
Oh, God. I remember when I moved to San Francisco, it was in 1987, and I had been living in Brooklyn. And produce in Manhattan, to get great produce, great apricots, great cherries, fruit, was expensive. I used to go to Fairway and would buy the perfect pear, the perfect apricot, and you paid top dollar. I moved to California and I was at 18th and Valencia, and there was a market right across the street, and you walked in there and there were apricots. I could buy a bushel of apricots for what I had paid for one in New York City. I fell madly in love with fruit smoothies and fresh fruit. It completely changed my life. I'd never been a fruit person, but suddenly I could afford anything, and it all tasted wonderful. Did you?
Yeah, I sort of always find that whenever I'm in San Francisco, I'm much more sort of, and I don't know if this is just because I'm a visitor, but focused on the kind of elemental foods, like the sort of raw ingredients. You know, like the fruits, going to the market and looking at and buying fruits, or you know, going to you know the good coffee place, or you know, a great bakery, and all the sort of buying just a great local cheese or something. Whereas I think there's something about New York that even though there are obviously like local artisan food producers, there's kind of I don't know if it's just that it's like an island culture or what it is, but there's a sense that it's like all sort of mixed up. And here there's kind of like it's all sort of, it seems to me like nicely divided up and, you know, pure. Like, you know, this is the great coffee place and this is all they're focused on and they're doing a great job and you want to go there for that. And, you know, it seems to me like somehow like much more organized and comprehensible.
Well, and then people will take you to the best burrito. And then, of course, there are like 80 different people, and they all have like 80 different taquerias.
Yes,
and
yes.
Then, of course, you have to go to 80 different taquerias and taste them. And it's
that's
so
not all bad.
No, it's a wonderful thing. I don't know that I remember from New York people being quite so passionate about their taqueria the way it is here. Have you had a burrito yet?
I have not.
Well, then we should talk about 16th Street.
Okay.
They're too busy eating foie gras. If I could bring just a little controversy into the discussion, I know, Amanda, you don't shy away from controversy in a lot of your writing.
Uh-huh.
About food. And I read there was a piece on Emeril Lagasse that perhaps was a little controversial. There was a discussion about the impact of Costco and wine. And the politics behind New York City's green market. We have a lovely ferry terminal farmers market now, and I was wondering if you could share some of the inside scoop with us here on the West Coast. Let's say the controversy, let's say, surrounding the green market in New York City.
Well, I mean, the green market in New York City is, you know, and I'm sure it's probably, you know, quite similar here. It's just that, you know, there are a lot of people with a lot of opinions who have been kind of involved in the green market for, you know, now decades. And, I mean, what I wrote about was they had hired a new director, this woman who had done, you know, an amazing thing, which was she's an American woman who grew up on a farm and moved to London and started their farmers market system there. And if you go to London, it's really quite a great system, and she still is an owner of it. Anyway, the New York City Green Market hired her as its director a few years ago, and so she just went in and sort of decided to kind of shake things up, and it was a little bit like oil and water, I think her intentions were good, but they weren't welcome. But that's all sort of over with, and now she left, and they're back to the same old thing.
Have you visited our fairy drum? Isn't it wonderful?
I try to go. And in fact, I ate at Boulette's Larder today for lunch.
Wonderful.
Yes, and I got in trouble for taking a photo.
Oh.
Yeah.
Very
strange.
Trade secrets.
Yes, I was scolded.
Oh.
I was holding up my camera, and the woman said, "Oh, may I help you?" I said, "Oh, I'm just taking a photo." And she said, "I would rather you not."
Why?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, Dorothy, if I could ask a controversial question of you.
Goody.
Your first novel was made into a movie on Showtime and actually had the distinction of being banned by Canada's Standards Bureau for its graphic telling of poverty and rape and child abuse. Would you like to discuss a little bit what that process was like about censorship, and how does one handle that?
With a sense of humor, it helps. Otherwise, you'd have to hunt them down and hurt them. And I could be persuaded to try that, but it's hard to hunt down an entire country and shake them to their bones. Literature is about complicated, difficult, painful material. It's about our real lives. And I actually am not interested in the cleaned-up, homogenized version of reality. The Canadian issue, though, was more painful because, in fact, that law, to a certain extent, was put in place as a remedy against violence and as a remedy against particularly violence against women and children. But the construction of the law means that works that deal seriously with those issues and try to tackle them head on become unspeakable. And then, of course, if you stop any discussion of the issue, you're not actually advancing the cause of either preventing violence or calling attention to it. In fact, you're stopping the discussion and allowing it to continue. And that is enormously painful to think about, to think that with all good intentions, people were doing harm in the name of for a cause they deeply believed in. It's makes more complicated. It'd be easy if I could just tell a nice, funny, cheap joke about it, but it's not cheap and it's not easy.
No, not at all.
Very painful.
Yeah.
But the movie did sell well in DVD.
Good.
Yes.
Yeah. Each of you has a very demanding lives, family, children. Demanding careers. How do you get that work-life balance? How many hours in the day are there for you?
Are you balanced?
Yeah. I was going to say, I stay up late. I don't know. I like what I do, so it's not, it sort of all blends together, you know?
And I'm completely unbalanced. So. It's the wonderful thing about being an artist is that you can follow your passions, and occasionally you notice that you might need to make a little bit more money, so you have to get serious and bear down. But no, all artists are unbalanced. It's the nature of the thing. We sweep from one emotion to another, and we get ourselves in trouble, and then we write about it.
And hopefully get the royalties, too. Oh,
voyeurism helps, yes.
Amanda, you are the mother of a twin boy and girl.
Uh-huh.
What are their favorite foods?
How old are they?
So they're two. They're like two and a half. And they've had kind of a strange kind of introduction to food because I was, the first 2 years of their life, I was testing recipes for this cookbook that, you know, spans 150 years. And so
hopefully not the lion's hearts.
They didn't have lion's heart, but they've had some very strange things, like they've eaten sea urchin, and they've, you know, they've eaten all sorts of organs. And it's really kind of been fascinating because I just decided that, well, I kind of had to. It was like I was cooking all this food, and it wasn't like I could then cook other meals for them. And also, I didn't really want to. I wanted them to just kind of see all foods as kind of equally interesting. And then if they didn't like them, they didn't, you know, then fine. They could reject them, but not. I didn't want to sort of start them out with just all these plain foods. Sort of an ongoing battle with our babysitter who thinks I'm a little crazy about it. But, you know, so essentially I just kind of have introduced them to this huge wide range, and so far so good, but I'm sure as soon as they go to school and it'll all be ruined.
What do they like?
Like everything. I mean, yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything they don't like. But, I mean, the other thing I do is I always serve dessert. Like, I don't make it a treat, and that's also been kind of interesting because they don't really like, it doesn't seem like anything special. It's just like the second part of the meal. So, I don't know. We'll see. I'll report back.
I could see them pulling out their school luncheons and saying, oh, darn, you know, sea urchin again.
Well, that's my hope.
Here's an interesting question, again, from the audience. Were most of the essays from cooks or from writers remembering what others cook for them? How much of the memory of food is about the making versus the eating?
Well, I actually would say that... really, the stories tend to be less about the food themselves. I mean, some are about the making and some are about the eating, but it's really, you know, kind of food as an entry point to, you know, a memory about, you know, their life. Like, for instance, Ann Patchett wrote about this meal that she had with her then boyfriend at Taille au Vin, which is this very fancy restaurant in Paris that is hard to get into, and you know, you would sort of plan a whole trip to Paris around if you were interested in food. And it's very anyway. So she goes, and it's the kind of place where you have like seven courses. And early on in the meal, she decided to play a word game with her boyfriend, which she knew the kind of it's like sort of a riddle-like game, and she knew the answer to, and he couldn't figure it out. And so after a little while, he just said, look, I'm done. Just tell me what, you know, tell me how it works. And she said, oh, no, you know, you've got to keep playing. Because she felt like if he could figure it out, there would be a lot of pleasure in that. And he didn't really want to, and so it became this kind of tug of war between them, where she was insisting that he continue playing, and he kind of gritting his teeth and doing so, and them arguing, and the relationship nearly fell apart by the time the meal was over. And she said that, you know, this. She says in the story that, you know, that this incredible bill lands on the table, and she realizes that she remembers nothing about the meal.
Oh, all that food.
Yeah, amnesia probably helps given the size of the check at Taille au Vin. Dorothy, you're an ardent supporter of independent booksellers and authors. Would you like to describe a little bit of some of the work and campaigning you're doing to support?
It's like I sometimes feel like I'm a big game hunter, and in New York City, there's very little game left. There's very little game left. It's daunting to me how embattled a lot of the independent bookstores have become. We actually have to do benefits for bookstores at this point, and that's deeply sad. Last night we were at Rakestraw Books in Danville, and the young man who runs the store baked elaborate cranberry, pecan, pumpkin something that people were going back for seconds and going, ooh. And I thought, he's going to survive. If he just keeps serving food, they'll keep coming in buying books. This is a new campaign. I'm actually going to start campaigning for bookstores to also be bakeries.
This sounds good to me.
Yeah, I think it might help. It's just, especially in difficult economic times, people will go for the discount and go to Costco.
I was recently in Brookline, Massachusetts, and actually there, the independent, the Barnes & Noble down the street has gone out of business,
yes.
And the independent has survived, which
well,
is sort of
it's
unheard
of. Homogenized publishing.
Yeah.
It's the Barnes & Noble. Have you been to these stores where the books are stacked by price? Here are the $3.98, here are the $5.98, here are the $8.88. There's no sense of love of the text, no sense of the importance of the words, the passion of the language. It's just a warehouse, whereas independent bookstores are almost always managed by local people who love books. And you go in and the books are arranged by theme, by content, and sometimes by glory, the passion of the bookseller. And I adore that.
Oh. You have a new business venture, Amanda, Seawinkle, is
mm-hmm.
it? Can you describe what that is? I didn't quite understand, but that's not surprising.
The idea behind Seawinkle is that we are increasingly living our lives online. You know, we instead of writing letters, we write emails or text messages, or all of our photos are online. We use Netflix, which so we get all of our movies and music online. What I was struck by a couple of years ago is that our lives are being recorded in incredible detail, a way that you could never, unless you were writing a journal all day long about everything you were doing, I mean, you couldn't possibly record all of these things about your life. But wouldn't it be amazing? Because right now everything online is very diffuse. It's like every service is kind of separate, and there's no way to integrate all of them. And so I thought, wouldn't it be great if you could actually pull together all of these threads and kind of have this, visual portrait of your life from day to day, year to year, and have something that you could actually pass on? I know this is kind of grim, but what does happen when you die? What happens to your email account, which contains so much incredible detail about who you are and your relationships? I guess because I'm a writer, I think a lot of writers kind of tend to sort of collect their words and their letters and things, and now there's just sort of no way to do it. And so Seawinkle is my small effort to try to find a way to do that.
What is a Seawinkle?
Seawinkle actually is a food, but it's not called a Seawinkle. It's actually a winkle. And some of you may actually, if you've been to England and have ever gotten like a seafood platter, they sometimes will serve winkles on it. And winkles are essentially just a sea snail. And what I love about winkles is that when you are served them, they give you a pin, because the only way to kind of extract them from their shell is to kind of dig in with a pin. And winkle.com was taken, so I had to do Seawinkle.
Well, sounds great. Here's a wonderful question, too. What is your favorite comfort food, if you each could comment?
Grits with cheese and maybe a few bacon bits, but grits.
Yeah. Do you find you're able to recreate some of the southern comfort foods?
Here?
In
no problem.
No problem.
California has more expatriate Southerners than you could possibly imagine, and they can all cook.
Should we watch for the Confederate flag somewhere?
No. We're the kind of Southerners who don't carry Confederate flags. Thank you very much. but we can all make grits with shrimp, and we can all make family dishes. And there was actually, for a while, you could go to potlucks in Berkeley, Southern potlucks, and people would bring all these exotic dishes, tripe, which I can't abide. We had this whole discussion. You know what tripe is, right?
Yes.
Yes. Well, we won't mention it on the air because everyone will stop eating for 3 days. but it would be wonderful. Great dishes and great food. California, there's lots of Southerners and good cooking.
Yeah. And Amanda, your favorite comfort
bread
food?
Bread and butter.
Bread and butter.
Yeah.
Home baked, of course.
Yeah. Well, it was just the food that my mother would always kind of serve me when we would go to my great grandmother's to keep me occupied.
Yeah. Continuing the food vein, where do you like to buy your food? Is it farmers markets, supermarkets, run out to your backyard and pick something? How does that work for each of you?
What I do is every Saturday we go to the green market. And it's not like the most amazing green market. You would probably think it's nothing here in San Francisco, but it's decent. And then I do a whole bunch of mixed shopping, which is, the thing about if you want to eat well in New York, I mean, you can get everything you want. I mean, New Yorkers love to brag that, you could get anything in the world there. But it takes so much effort that you're exhausted by the end. You have to sort of go all over the place to kind of get the really interesting stuff. So I kind of do that in little bits. And I do a fair amount of mail ordering. And I also do this service, which I don't know if you have in San Francisco, but it's called Fresh Direct.
Yes.
Do you have that here?
If not, call that.
It's called something else. It's kind of, the lazy way to shop, but, it is a good thing.
You call them up or order online.
You order online, right, which I love.
Right. Well, but see, I live up in Sonoma County, and if I ordered online, they'd never find the house. So, and the big thing is the 24-hour Safeway, where you can get your basics. But there are two good local produce markets on Highway 116 that have astonishing produce. One that's only open in the summer, spring and summer, and one that's open year-round. And it has wonderful food. The largest selection of beans I've seen in my life.
Hmm.
And if you're from the South, you're a connoisseur of beans.
Well, terrific. Well, we're in the part of the program now where we have time for one last question. And let's make it topical. What are you serving for the holidays?
Oh, that is a great question. I haven't figured it out yet.
Are you still testing recipes for?
No, I'm mostly done testing recipes. But yeah, I know for basically for 5 years, I was always doing a recipe test. So it's kind of liberating. Maybe I'll actually just make an old favorite. But are you going to make duck or?
No, I made duck just before Thanksgiving. I made duck in order to have stock to make good turkey gravy.
Mm.
I know it sounds strange, but there you go. No, they asked me to make a ham this Christmas. God knows what I'll do for New Year's. But there has to be, I know that I have to have greens and black-eyed peas. It's because I was raised by my mother, who genuinely believed that if you did not eat greens and black-eyed peas on New Year's Day, you wouldn't have any money the following year. And considering the economy, I'm going to make a hell of a lot of greens and black-eyed peas.
Please buy plenty for all of us.
I know, actually, I remember one thing I will make, which is monkey bread. Does anyone know what bread is?
My son made monkey bread. It was one of the things they taught him in school.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Yes.
And there's kind of, there are sort of sweet and savory. Did he make the sweet or the savory one?
Makes sweet.
Sweet. Well, that's the sort of the fun one. And it's basically, it's like almost like a brioche-like dough, and you break it into little pieces and roll it into balls. And dip it in butter and then cinnamon sugar, and then just drop it into a tube pan and bake it. And they call it monkey bread because you can sort of pick at it and pull the pieces. And that was a childhood food for me.
Well, the trick in our house is that my son got the biscuit mix from Safeway, and that's what he used.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
You take that stuff, roll it in butter and cinnamon, you've got a delicacy regardless who made it.
Well, that's great. Anyway, with our thanks to Amanda Hesser and Dorothy Allison, editor and contributor respectively, to the new book, Eat, Memory, Great Writers at the Table, a collection of food-related essays from the New York Times. Amanda Hesser is an author and food columnist at the New York Times. Dorothy Allison is the author of Bastard Out of Carolina and Cave Dweller. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. This program is part of our Food Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Barbara Otto, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.